Brass bands, today's chosen great life once said, are all very well in their place, outdoors and several miles away. Acerbic, observant, direct. My guest today nominating him is as sharp-minded, as, on occasions, sharp-tongued, as charming, and even on occasions as brutal as the musician he's chosen to champion. David Mellor, the opera and classical music critic of The Mail on Sunday, has been a barrister, Tory MP, Secretary of State, journalist and broadcaster. He was Britain's first sport, media and culture secretary. He's pulled my arguments to pieces in parliamentary standing committees when he was the minister ramming through a bill and I was the capricious backbencher playing games with it. He's an intriguing combination of apparently thick-skinned and almost pitiless mental muscle and enlightened, civilised political moderation. In the media, we've since come to know him as a pundit on football too, which, for pity's sake, let's try to avoid for the next half hour. And, of course, classical music. To which, let's go now. Listen to this.
There's only one way to rehearse an orchestral piece, which is what I do.
What's that?
I take either a Mozart symphony or a Strauss tone poem. I play the whole thing through from beginning to end without a stop. Oh, blessed thing. The orchestra makes a few mistakes, naturally. I played through a second time. The orchestra makes no mistakes. I then just take a few little difficult parts. I repeat those three or four times. What does a young conductor do? Who will never profit by anybody else's experience,
naturally.
Thanks to his unconquerable egotism and innate stupidity. Yes. He will take a first-class orchestra, and after playing 20 bars, he will stop, and he'll begin educating them. Fancy educating a body of people like the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. They already know the damn piece 10 lines better than he does. That's why he wants 6 rehearsals, and that's why I can do with 2.
David Mellor, of all the celebrated 20th century conductors, Malcolm Sargent, Henry Wood, Barbarolli, Toscanini, you've chosen, in the most gifted and wonderful sense, quite a brute. The fellow, in fact, who called Toscanini a glorified Italian bandmaster. Why Sir Thomas Beecham?
First of all, of course, he's a wonderful character. His greatest artistic achievement was probably the creation of his own personality. But the great thing about Beecham is he was a wonderful conductor. And that very style that you heard in that wonderfully orotund way he spoke comes out in his music making. And that's why almost 50 years after his death, you will still find Beecham, the locus classicus for those of us who spend our lives listening to music, on so many pieces that not only, as people would say, he could make a second-class piece of music sound first-class, but in a whole lot of first-class pieces of music as well. Also, I think we have to bear in mind that music was not well organised in Britain. Never has been, really. And Beecham spent the family money from the Beecham's Pills Empire putting on operas. I mean, you can't believe this, but we always think people in previous generations were so much more cultivated than us. But when Beecham put on a Mozart operas in Edwardian times, a critic of the Sunday Times wrote that it'd be interesting to hear Don Giovanni, and we might then learn whether Mozart had a future in the opera house. I mean, and Beecham also created cultural organisations that survived him. I mean, he set up a number of orchestras, of which the London Philharmonic in 1932 revolutionised orchestral standards in its country. It's still doing jolly well today. And the Royal Philharmonic, that was his last great love, founded in 1946, that's still going strong. So if you want Beecham's memorial, look around. The world of British music was changed forever by Thomas Beecham, and basically for the better.
To help us understand how it was changed, we also have with us John Lucas, author of An Obsession with Music, a biography of Sir Thomas Beecham. Perhaps, John, our first task is not to get too stuck into Beecham's early life, because it's absolutely fascinating and could fill a programme by itself, but just remind us, would you, of where in life and commerce and society he came from.
Well, he came from very unusual circumstances. His grandfather was a shepherd in Oxfordshire who acted as a vet for the sheep and treated them with herbs he found in the fields. And he eventually realised the medicines that he produced were very good for healing humans too. So he ended up in St Helens, a town in industrial South Lancashire, and he started to make quite a nice fortune. He had a son called Joseph, who he took into the firm, and before long it had turned into a multi-million pound enterprise. And people have always assumed Thomas was always incredibly rich as a result. and that had it not been for his father's money, he would have never have got anywhere. This is absolute nonsense, because in 1899, Joseph, his father, put his mother, Josephine, in a lunatic asylum for no better reason, as far as it can be made out, than that she rather got in the way of his amatory adventures. And the poor woman...
Those were the days. The,
couldn't get away with it now, David.
Beecham, who then was aged about 18, and his eldest sister, got her out of this lunatic asylum, and for his pains, Joseph threw Thomas out of the house, and they didn't speak to each other for 9 years. And during those 9 years, Thomas created an orchestra. He made his debut in the opera house. It was only because of that that his father decided he couldn't bear it any longer, particularly when Edward VII was heard to be coming along to attend one of the performances. He had just had to be there. He couldn't stand it any longer.
And then, of course, once he got back with his dad, he spent his father's money.
Then he spent,
yes. You know, not on wine, women and song and the rest he wasted sort of thing, but he actually spent it on musical activities. And, you know, we have to remember, these days, Covent Garden is heavily subsidised, and quite rightly so. In those days, it wasn't. And so unless you had a man like Thomas Beecham, who not only put his father's money in, but also demanded and commanded, a lot of his other society friends did, there would have been virtually no cultural life in London whatsoever. Certainly not important premieres of works like Salome and stuff like that, which really did create a sensation.
Let's bring in our second expert here. Leanne Langley is, unusually for a Texan, a social historian of music in Britain. Leanne, we should establish early on the music and concert-going scene into which Beecham was launching himself. David has given some sense of that.
Yes, it's perfectly true that opera would require vast amounts of money to mount and to put on properly to attract people. But there was another strain of musical life in this country, even earlier than that, which would be called concert life, orchestral concerts. And the great change that occurred just before Thomas Beecham comes on the scene at about the age of 20 is a switch from fundamentally subscription systems where well-known or wealthy or select society people joined a subscription list in advance and paid their money up front for a short series of concerts. There was a shift from that model to what we call the gate, where anybody can come. The concert halls are bigger. Indeed, Queen's Hall opened in 1893, allowing close on 3,000 or even more if you take out the seats in the floor area so that people could stand. And the idea was stack them high but sell them cheap.
But this was the problem, of course, of musical life. Because it was dependent on the box office, the arrangements for rehearsals were wretched. And, of course, a lot of musicians had, orchestral musicians, had very little by way of money to make a living. So if they got a better offer going out and playing in a theatre band, they'd send along the deputies. And the deputies were the ruination of orchestral life and orchestral standards in this country. And this is what Beecham changed. First of all, with the Beecham Symphony Orchestra, which was a lot of young musicians that he trained and made into a crack ensemble. And then in 1932 with the London Philharmonic, where deputies were not allowed, and suddenly Britain had an orchestra capable of holding its own with the Berlin Philharmonic and the great American orchestras.
Let's listen to a couple of examples of his conducting in which we can hear his voice too. First this.
Innuendo.
And then there was what was apparently called the towing path shout. Hey. Even through the crackle and hiss and mists of that half century, you can hear the sheer physical energy of the man.
Well, it's a physical drive in the music as well, that he was very, very good at the rhythmic vitality.
He had perfect rhythm.
And the shaping of phrases, so that the dynamic shaping of a phrase was so different from what anyone else could do.
That is so important, because, you see, it's not just in Britain and the British. Beecham became a tax exile late in his life, in the 50s, when he died in 1961. He said that Britain was a place that, because of the weather, you couldn't live, and because of death duties, you couldn't afford to die. Very current point now, we are in current political controversy. Anyway, as a result of that, he started to record with the French National Radio Orchestra. Now, if you listen to his recording of Carmen, it's simply wonderful. But the point is that when this bizarre Englishman with his pointed beard and his suits and very sort of, you know, appeared in front of these French musicians, I mean, they didn't know what to make of him. But at the end of the first session, the leader of the orchestra, you know, the first violin, the primer, he looked at the band and he said, "Satan Dieu."
He's a god. Yeah. What was his conducting style, John? I've never seen him conduct.
Well, it's rather hard to describe.
Yes.
He left his left hand hanging quite a lot, didn't he?
A certain amount, yes. Funny, I had a letter the other day from a BBC Symphony Orchestra player, and he said, we were doing the Liszt First Piano Concerto with Clifford Curzon, and Beecham started with his baton under his left armpit, and he swung it until it was higher in the heavens to the right of him, and the whole orchestra just came in with this extraordinary gesture. And he said, but it wasn't just the big gestures, it was the little one. He could wag his finger at you and you would get a marvellous effect. It was very hard.
I think it was the eyes too. He had a penetrating gaze.
But it was with the eyes.
It was with
the
eyes.
If you ever see a film of him.
When you start with the very best pick of the players of the whole nation, that's what he could always do, was very easily find the best players, because they wanted to play with him, because he would let them play. Unlike some conductors, as he described in that clip, who always wanted to stop and tell them how to do it and have a discussion about it. He just let them play. Yes. If you've got great players, you can let them play.
This must all have made Beecham himself quite a well-known figure.
Oh, yes, he was very well-known. And also, you see, he was well-known because of his extramarital activities, so and also his rows with the father over the mother, and then he was taken to court. He was co-respondent in various divorce cases. He was a big, you know, you can see from, again, I go back to that wonderful interview that you played with him, the man slightly gloried in a degree of raffish notoriety combined with what I admire, which was all of the absolutely terrific verve that you heard in the voice being translated into a determination to make the British a more sophisticated musical nation.
He was accused in court of adultery, and all his life his affairs were picked over in the press. He seems to have taken up and left relationships as it suited him, John.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, I think there's one point that he seemed to have three ladies at once, didn't he? I mean,
and he was quite proud of his reputation of that, because there was one opera he was conducting, the producer was requiring the soprano, it was quite commonplace these days, obviously less common then, to lie on the floor while singing her aria. And she said it was very difficult to perform like that. And Beecham said, "Madam, I've given some of my best performances in that position."
Did it damage him, his reputation for sexual philandering?
I think it was.
What would you say?
No, I think Maud Cunard had a lot to do with his success, I would say. Not only her money, but her verve and her energy.
Yes, this was the Lady Cunard. She was the divorced wife of an extremely wealthy man.
No, she wasn't divorced.
Man.
She never divorced him.
Oh, she never divorced him?
No.
She was the separated wife, though I don't suppose it would have mattered to Beecham whether they were separated or not. But she was able to take him up. But no, I think the thing about Thomas Beecham was he was a card, you would say in old parlance. The thing about Thomas Beecham was that he was a character. You know, even the unmusical would be drawn to a Thomas Beecham concert because there was something about the man that transcended what he did.
You, David, in years gone by, had a hell of a rumpus over your own private life. He appears, as you say, to have transcended it. You must slightly envy him.
But in a bit of way, but perhaps I was not as funny as him, or indeed as talented.
You're listening to BBC Radio 4 and Great Lives with Matthew Paris. My guest this week is David Meller, and along with our experts, John Lucas and Leanne Langley, we're discussing the life of the conductor Sir Thomas Beecham. Here's a recording of Sir Thomas conducting the finale of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony. Funny thing about this is that he was actually, in his time, very rude about Beethoven. In fact, I think He described the Seventh Symphony, didn't he, David, as like a herd of yaks jumping
about?
Yes,
about the third movement. But you see, the point about it is, Beecham would have partly believed that, and partly he would say it for effect. You've got to remember that he was as proud of his personality as he was of his musicianship, and so he would say these things in a carefree way. But I tell you what, Beecham's performances of the Seventh Symphony, we have both a studio one that, again, amazingly, was made over sessions that lasted over 15 months, and yet somehow you listen to the performance, it's so coherent. But also that live one that we've just heard a bit of now. Beecham could do that music. It's just that what he never felt was he had to do all of it, or he had to be especially reverent towards the creator. We live in a mealy-mouthed age. Thomas was not mealy-mouthed.
No,
or
he certainly
indeed,
wasn't.
May I say, politically correct. You'd never allow him on the BBC these days.
I'm sorry to hear that he didn't mean everything that he said.
Oh, that's not. Mr. Gladstone. Beethoven's
Mr. Musical Gladstone. Mr. Gladstone, that's right, yes. But you see, he'd say the first thing that came to his head spontaneously. I mean, again, John will tell me whether this is true. I hope this one is true, because John, with his many researchers, thinks that some of the stuff that's attributed to Beecham isn't right. But the one I like, he's conducting the Meistersingers, and the final tableau, a horse is led on. It's not a very good performance of the Meistersingers, and the horse, no sooner getting its moment and centre of events, and it lifts its tail and does things horribly all over the stage. And Sir Thomas, without batting an eyelid or turning a hair, says, "Ah, gentlemen, not just an artist, but a critic as well." I mean, it's jolly clever, that. You've got to admit, you know?
But you said that he was politically incorrect, and I don't regard myself as foolishly politically correct, but some of his remarks about women and women in music actually don't even seem to me funny any longer, Leanne. What do you think?
No, I think it's quite shocking the way he treated women, but he had his father as an example, didn't he? Mm. I mean, I think it's to his credit.
And his grandfather.
And his grandfather was a real rounder. I mean, his grandfather was the worst of all, and Thomas was quite close to that grandfather, wasn't he? Closer than he was to his own father, Joseph.
Yeah. Beecham didn't believe that women should play in orchestras, did he? Now, that's more than just the wit of the era.
Oh, I don't think that's true.
He wasn't the only one who didn't think
no,
that
I
should
think that's true,
orchestras.
Is it?
No, it's not true. Except he didn't have women in the LPO or the RPO.
He didn't want women in the LPO or the RPO. No. It was Henry Wood who, in 1913, yes, hired six women.
Yes.
Henry Wood was the leader there.
And the BBC Symphony Orchestra started to introduce
but
women.
But his wife, Betty Humby, he regularly accompanied. I think we have to remember, Beecham was refined as a wit. And OK, maybe it now sounds a bit contrived and mannered, but, you know, he loved to do that kind of thing because it was part of his personality to be seen as a wit.
You talk of recording, David, and Beecham grasped very early and never forgot the importance of recording. Did he enjoy recording?
The thing about Beecham is that I don't think he ever realised how important it was to record all of the things he did well for posterity, and he didn't. And also, he took an infernal amount of time over his recordings. Quite a lot of his recordings, I always look at the dates that these recordings are made, and you find that the studio version of the Beethoven 7th took over 15 months, so he was very casual about it. And in fact, a number of recordings were left unfinished at his death, bits of this, bits of that.
The other important thing is that recording was an immensely important source of income.
Exactly, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. He wanted to give work to the players,
exactly,
and he knew that was a very fruitful source, yeah, of income. Bearing in mind his reputation and the dissemination internationally, the best way to do it was on disc. Mm. The amazing thing to me is that his recording career spans the entire history of the development technologically of the recording medium.
Yeah.
So you can start in 1910 and go to 1959. He has some of the first recordings on what we'd call cassette tape, because it was at the BASF factory in the 1930s,
yes,
when that was a brand new technique. And he was, I think he was interested in the technology once he understood the international currency of recordings.
Let's come back to money. It's a mistake, isn't it, to imagine that Beecham simply inherited the family fortune and spent it. A great deal that his father and grandfather made was kept out of his hands.
Oh, yes.
And what he had, he got into quite a lot of trouble with, didn't he?
He did. He appeared twice in the bankruptcy courts. On both occasions, he got off by the skin of his teeth. But after the, say, the 1920s, he never had much money of his own, but he was extremely good at spending other people's. And when he died, he left the equivalent today of about £60,000, which is a surprisingly little amount.
My producer's been talking to Beecham's son, Paul Strang. Paul was born in 1933. His mother was the singer Dora Labette. Beecham had a long relationship with her, though he never married her. Here is the son, Paul.
He had no sort of moral conscience about money. He was very generous. But on the other hand, like so many people, you know, their genius is in direct proportion to the amount of indulgence you have to give them. He was always off to the court to get money out of the family trust to pay his debts, particularly the Inland Revenue. There's a famous occasion when he got a rude letter from the Inland Revenue when he was in America, and he blasted in public against this pipsqueak or whatever it was. That poor man had already come to do is to ask for some money, taxes which he owed. But that was his attitude towards creditors.
How often did you see him?
When I was a student, I used to go to quite a lot of the concerts, and he would say, come round and see me afterwards, but more often than not, he'd gone because other people were also wanting to see him about other matters.
What, like money?
Possibly. He distributed his favour amongst the London hotels very liberally.
But you obviously have a great affection for him.
Oh, indeed. Indeed. Well, you couldn't possibly help it. It's very strange, you know, because when I hear a record of his, of perhaps a record which I don't know, or just you switch on the radio and something comes up, I know instantly that it's him. Something clicks, you know. Quite bizarre.
Is there such a thing, David, as the Beecham stamp in musical terms? Can you listen to a piece of music and know, because of the way it sounds, that it was Beecham?
Well, I tell you something. The late Alan Blythe, who was one of the great critics of The Voice, said to me, the opening of Act 4 of La Boheme, a couple of chords before the duet between Marcello and Rodolfo, and he said, you've only got to listen to that first 15 seconds to know that this Beecham, because Beecham's La Boheme with Jussi Björling and Victoria de Los Angeles is the great recording. And he said, you've only got to listen to those 15 seconds to know that you're dealing with a great conductor. You wouldn't necessarily know it was Beecham as against a handful of other great conductors, but the crispness, the élan, there's something about a great conductor that's totally different from a bloke, however talented. And you've got to be pretty talented even to get a chance to play with a great symphony orchestra. But, you know, a routinier cannot get that woof that is Beecham, you know.
What happens to Beecham in the run-up to and in the Second World War? There was some criticism of his visiting Nazi Germany.
Yes, he went to Germany with a tour with the London Philharmonic in 1936. He also had a chance to record with the Berlin Philharmonic, the Magic Flute. And also, of course, he was happy to employ German singers at Covent Garden, even though some of them were notorious Nazis. But I think, as far as Beecham was concerned, it was not that he had any respect for Hitler. I think when Hitler attended one of the LPO concerts, I think he said at the end, well, the old bugger seemed to like it. But I just don't think he had any political sense at all. As far as he was concerned, he was making music. And there's no doubt, if you're interested in music, the place you would want to go and make music, the kind of music he wanted to make, was in Germany. Mm. I think he was hugely bucked by the fact that he got a wonderful reception there from the audiences. And if you were putting on Mozart and stuff like that at Covent Garden, you would want German singers. Where I think he's more open to criticism is that he did abscond from the country in, what, 1940, John, and spent most of the war lucratively touring America, and was not there when the going was at its toughest. But once again, being Beecham, when he came back in 1944 and took up the baton again, everyone forgave him quite readily, as they tended to forgive all his other sins.
He becomes, John, as he gets much older, a little bit of a caricature of himself, doesn't he,
and plays right up to it. And he really played up to this caricature. Mm. I mean, if you listen to some of the speeches he made at the end of concerts, they don't sound terribly funny now.
No, they don't.
And I'm not quite sure why some of them have been thought funny enough to have put on CDs. But I think the older he got, the more he liked to present himself as the funny old gentleman.
He may have felt he was losing his grip musically back home as well.
Well, of course, he had lost his musical grip on the way music was organised in this country.
Yeah. And he was not allowed back at Covent Garden. That was a terrific blow to him.
He was very shabbily treated, you know, because having done what he did in the 30s, and even though he didn't make life all that easy for himself by being a tax exile through a lot of the 50s, and it's an extraordinary thing that the last opera that he conducted in England was an obscure French opera in Bath in 1954. Was it Zemir et Azor?
Yeah.
Oh,
that was great.
And you think, you know, when you listen to his Carmen, stuff like that, you realise that, you know, he should have been asked to Covent Garden, where he would have really done some wonderful work. But I think there was a reaction against Beecham by the musical establishment in the last decade of his life. Which,
well, there was a reaction
people
before
should be ashamed
that,
of.
Actually.
Yes,
the BBC tried to keep him out, definitely, in 1930. from the orchestra that they were forming, because they knew he was going to be trouble.
Yes, I think after the war and the formation of the Covent Garden Opera Company, I think it was quite reasonable not to ask Beecham to run the thing, because he would have made a complete hash of the money.
But not even to invite him as a guest conductor.
But that was the... Yes. That was what was unforgivable.
Criminal, really.
Yes.
Well, when he died in 1961, the London Evening News led with an 8-column banner headline on page one. There was no doubting his celebrity, and that there's surely, David, even to this day, no other classical conductor whose name recognition has seeped into the fabric of our English national consciousness
did. The nearest you could say in contemporary times was the death of Pavarotti, because Pavarotti, as a tenor, of course, not a conductor, the idea of Pavarotti conductor is quite amusing, but not something he tried to do. But Pavarotti, you see, was also a larger-than-life figure. And Pavarotti also, of course, was capable of attracting in an audience that was not your core classical music audience. And so was Beecham. The thing about Beecham was that, you know, he also loved to conduct light music and stuff like that. Beecham was a character who, the British love a character, he transcended the conventional career of a classical musician. And so his death became a matter of national note above and beyond just the fact he stood on a podium and waved his hands around.
We're an odd nation, and in our language the word popularise can't escape a distinct sneering undertone, and he was a great populariser. You'll have heard it about the radio station for which you've done so much, Classic FM, David. Did Thomas Beecham's instinct for the public platform make or damage him as a great musician?
I think it made him as a great musician, because don't forget, what he was doing was promoting music that he believed in, and music that, with the partial exception of Delius, we now rate. I mean, who could imagine a world without Mozart operas? But Beecham pretty much discovered a world without Mozart operas, or without Mozart symphonies, without the symphonies of Sibelius. Through the 1930s, Beecham took up Sibelius and was a magnificent conductor of Sibelius right to the end of his life. And I think that Beecham's musical instincts were good instincts, and what he wanted to bring forward was, generally speaking, music that was worth people while listening. And even little trifles he did, you know, there's a wonderful pantomime from this Zemir e Azor I was mentioning, last opera conductor here. It's beautiful music. Anyone who just wants to hear 5 minutes of pure joy should listen to that and some of the other lollipops he did. He had exquisite musical taste, and even if, as you told me earlier, his taste in rebuking ladies left something to be desired, his musical taste, even in these challenging times, rides triumphantly on.
You've been listening to Great Lives, and thank you to my guest this week, David Meller, and our two expert witnesses, John Lucas and Leanne Langley, for helping us explore the life of Sir Thomas Beecham.